everybody, and welcome back to All Crime, No Cattle. We have another installment for you. This is episode 40, and we are, of course, a Texas true crime podcast. I am Detective Shea Butter, and as always, across from me, we have the wonderful, the gorgeous, the ever-curly Bone Lady, Miss Erin. Say hi, Erin.
Hi, guys. And of course, don't forget the ACNC canine unit.
Oh, as always.
Who has been as useful as they always are, which is to say, not at all.
Yep, that's right. They are just napping away, snoozing it, over on the podcasting futon.
Yep.
But you know what? They got to rest up. They do a lot. They got their own podcast thing going. They solve crimes on the side. You know, it's tough work being part of the canine crime unit. We got any cleanup this episode?
Yes, actually. Before we begin, we have not one, but two updates on cases that we've covered here on the show.
Ooh, interesting.
The first is that Joseph Garcia was executed on December 4th, so this past Tuesday. Garcia was part of the infamous Texas 7 prison break that resulted in the murder of Officer Aubrey Hawkins in December of 2000. We covered the case of the Texas 7 in episodes 17 and 18. As you might recall, Garcia was originally serving a 50-year sentence for the murder of Miguel Luna, which is why he was in prison to begin with. Miguel Luna's family was there to witness Garcia's execution. Of the seven members, Garcia was the fourth to be executed, joining Michael Rodriguez, George Rivas, and Donald Newberry. As we know, Larry Harper committed suicide to avoid recapture. And in breaking news that was just announced Monday, December 10th, one of the remaining two members of the Texas 7, Patrick Murphy, has now been scheduled for execution on March 28th. The remaining member, Randy Halperin, is still on death row and is awaiting his execution date as well. Garcia was the 12th person to be executed in Texas in 2018, with at least one more scheduled before the end of the year. Our second update comes from episode 33 about the serial murders in September of 2018 in Laredo. Border Patrol agent Juan David Ortiz was indicted for capital murder on Wednesday, December 5th, for the murders of Melissa Ramirez, Claudine Loera, Griselda Hernandez-Cantu, and Nikki Enriquez. District Attorney Isidro Alanis has announced that he will indeed be seeking the death penalty, stating, quote, "The factors I considered in pursuing the death penalty against Ortiz are the following. The horrific nature of the murders, his complete disregard of human life, his vigilante mentality, and he violated his oath to his country and to his agency to protect and defend the Constitution and thereby the community," end quote. We will continue to update you when more news comes up about that case. One thing that has changed since that episode that we put out is that it was originally reported that Ortiz did not use his service weapon in the alleged commission of the murders. It is now being reported that his service weapon may have been what was actually used in some or all of the murders. Ballistics testing is still pending to confirm or deny that possibility.
Oh. Well, I know that was a big question of ours during that episode, so that'll be interesting to find that out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, with all that cleanup out of the way, I guess we can get right into episode 40.
Yes, we can. And it's actually interesting that both of these updates have to do with capital murder charges and the death penalty, because the case today is another very important death penalty case in Texas history as well. Before we begin, this case is strange in that it's a big, important case, but there is actually surprisingly little information out there about the specifics, and there is very, very little information available about the victims. In fact, in all cases, I could not find a single photo of the victims to share with you all. This is, I think, a story that needs to be told, and if there's anyone out there who wants to do an in-depth investigation or a book on a Texas case, this might be a great candidate just because I'm sure there's so much more to the story, so much left to be told, especially about the victims. So let's get into our sources. The main sources I used to get as many details as possible were all of the appeals documents that I could get my hands on. As we'll see, there were a lot of appeals surrounding this case. I also use articles from the Texas Execution Information Center, the Dallas Morning News, the Associated Press, and the United Press International. For information to make sense of the court proceedings, I used a website called deathpenaltyinfo.org. If you have questions about the history of the death penalty here in the United States, that is a really great resource for the layman. Another good website for this info is txexecutions.org. And this case is actually a listener suggestion. So thank you to Michael A., who suggested this to us on Facebook. Michael has a bit of a connection to the case, so if you're listening and you have any further details you'd like to add or you think we've missed anything, please get back in touch with us and let us know.
Yeah, thanks, Michael, for sending that in.
Well, this case takes place along State Highway 380 between the towns of McKinney and Princeton, Texas, in Collin County. This area is about an hour north-northeast of Dallas, just to get you kind of situated as to where we are in the state. Both McKinney and Collin County are named after Collin McKinney, one of the signers of the Texas Declaration of Independence and a congressman for the Republic of Texas.
Oh, really?
That's right. McKinney has a population of about 180,000 people today, and it's experiencing a booming population growth right now. But back in the 1970s, when this case occurred, the population was about 10,000 people, so a lot smaller.
Yeah, I bet it was much more rural, much more farmland and undeveloped back then. They've got a lot of development going on out there now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, Princeton, the town just east of McKinney, today has a population of less than 10,000. So we can imagine it was probably teeny tiny back in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
If you'd like to get to know Princeton more, you should go visit in April to catch the annual Princeton Onion Festival, where they have a car show, arts and crafts, food, including an onion cook-off, and a Miss Onion pageant.
What do you do in an onion cook-off? I mean, how best to serve an onion?
I guess that's what it is, yeah.
Can you just serve it up anyway? Or does it have to be a blooming onion? I have so many questions about this onion cook-off.
Well, we're going to have to go in this coming April.
Yeah. Okay, and the Miss Onion pageant, I'm guessing, is just a beauty pageant, and then you're Miss Onion. It doesn't have anything to do
exactly,
with...
which I am going to enter myself in.
Oh.
When we go.
Okay.
But apparently all of this is because this is a really farming rich area.
Oh, okay.
And the onion crop is one of the main crops that we grow here in this area of Texas.
Yeah. Hardy plant.
Yeah.
Good in the dry climate.
Uh-huh. And all of the proceeds from the Princeton Onion Festival go to the Angel Tree Program, which collects and distributes gifts to children. So it's a really great cause. Yeah, perfect. Located on State Highway 380 between the towns of McKinney and Princeton was a little rural grocery store and gas station named the Hilltop Grocery Store. So this is a, like you were saying, a tiny store located between two small towns, the kind of place you'd go to grab some milk and some bread, get some gas, and have a chat with a store owner, 73-year-old Preston Broyles. And on the morning of May 11th, 1974, at around 6 to 6:30 in the morning, that's exactly what Gary Coker and Billy St. John, both 18 years old, stopped in to do. They were headed to Dallas for work in Billy's red pickup truck, and stopped at Hilltop Grocery to get some oil for the truck. Preston Broyles sold them the oil and even went outside with them to help them put it in the truck. At around 7 a.m., Leonard Davis and his wife arrived at Hilltop Grocery to get gas for their vehicles. When they arrived at the store, they heard a noise inside and went in to take a look. Davis immediately smelled gunpowder and was alarmed to see Preston Broyles laying dead in a pool of blood to the right of the door. The body of 18-year-old Gary Coker lay a few feet away in front of the meat counter, also dead and covered in blood. Billy St. John was also on the ground, but when Davis approached him, the man lifted himself on his elbows and called out for help. Davis and his wife called 911, and Billy was rushed to the Collin Memorial Hospital, but it wasn't long before he too succumbed to his injuries. He had been shot four times in the torso. It was determined after his autopsy that he had been shot while lying face down on the floor.
Oh my gosh.
Preston Broyles and Gary Coker had likewise been shot to death while laying on the ground. So this is very much what we describe as execution style, with all three men lying face down on the floor, no signs of a struggle or defensive wounds. All three men had multiple bullet wounds to the heads and torso.
Wow, that's brutal. Execution style right there. And what time? This was early in the morning.
Yes. So they're found at about 7 a.m.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Preston Broyles' daughter would later comment that this made the grief even worse for their family. Due to the damage to the face and head of her father, the family wasn't able to see him after his death or have an open casket at his funeral. So essentially, they felt like they couldn't say goodbye to him.
Hmm.
Which is obviously just devastating if you have that tradition of open casket funerals and that's the way you grieve and are comforted over the loss of a loved one, to have that taken away from you is just so sad.
Yeah, if that's your tradition, and like you said, in your culture and religion, I imagine that's hard if you're not allowed that opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. A total of 12 30 caliber shell casings were recovered from the scene, and all three men's wallets were missing. And the cash register, found open, only had coins inside, so all of the bills were missing. So this definitely looks like a robbery.
Mm.
The victims' wallets were later found empty along highways in Collin County. One was found only a mile and a half away from the store.
So they're pitching out the wallets after they've raided them as they're going through them and throwing them out on the side of the road.
Yeah, definitely. Well, there was little evidence for the police to go on. DNA evidence wasn't around yet, and there was no surveillance cameras. The only lead they had was a witness statement about a car seen outside the store around the time of the murders. The witness was passing by the store on Highway 380 that morning and saw St. John's red truck next to the gas pumps with an oil can on the roof. He also saw a light-colored vehicle parked nearby and recognized the store owner, Preston Broyles, standing by this vehicle. As he watched, he saw a man with a gun step out of the light-colored vehicle and start walking to where Broyles stood. Leonard Davis and his wife, the couple who found the victims, also stated that as they drove to the store that morning, they had passed a light-colored vehicle headed in the opposite direction. So we have a light-colored car seen at the store around the time of the murders, along with someone with a gun, and a light-colored car is seen leaving from the direction of the scene shortly after the murders. And that's pretty much all investigators had to go on. So it's possible that this triple homicide could have languished for years, decades, perhaps be even unsolved today. But that didn't happen, because against all expectations, someone stepped forward to claim responsibility for the murders at the Hilltop grocery store. And that person was 36-year-old Robert XL White, who showed up at the Boulevard Sheriff's Department in Mississippi to confess to the triple homicide.
Wow. Okay.
Now, a little comment on this guy's name. His middle name, the name that he commonly went as, everybody knew him as XL or XL. I'm not sure exactly how I'm supposed to pronounce that name. I can't find anywhere where there's any interviews where he says his name or anybody else says his name. And that's obviously a very unique name. I've never heard of somebody named XL or XL. It's spelled like Excel, E-X-C-E-L-L with a double L.
Yeah, I could see it either way, especially in the South. I could see him being Excel or Excel. It's a unique name, though, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So I just want to put it out there that I'm not 100% sure on how to pronounce it, so I might kind of pronounce it either way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, tell me about this guy and what's going on with him turning himself in Mississippi.
Well, White was born March 14th, 1938 in Mississippi. He had dropped out of school in the 10th grade. He had worked as an auto mechanic for at least some or all of his life, or at least in the period before these murders. He had no previous criminal background, so on paper, it didn't seem like this would be the man responsible for such a grisly and baseless crime. But then, White started talking. And when he started, he didn't stop until he had recounted the full tale of the murders at Hilltop Grocery and the murder of yet another man just hours before.
Really? So a fourth victim?
That's right. According to White's confession, on May 9th, he'd began drinking at his local bar in Waco, which is where he lived, around noon, and he didn't stop drinking until 1 a.m. the following morning.
Oh, boy.
He then left the bar, gave his wife a ride home, and then proceeded to the home of 53-year-old avid gun collector Roy Perryman. It was now the very early morning of May 10th. The two continued to drink together. It's not exactly clear what kind of relationship White and Perryman had, but it sounds like they were at least acquaintances, if not friends.
Well, it would seem that way if you've gone out for a long night of drinking, then you've driven home, dropped your wife off, and then gone over to seemingly a buddy or friend's house to hang out and drink some more.
Yeah, at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
That's definitely an assumption I think you could make. Well, while talking and drinking, Perryman had offered to sharpen White's knife. Sometime after, White then pounced on Perryman, stabbing him repeatedly with a knife Perryman had just sharpened for him.
Holy crap.
As he stabbed Perryman to death, White told him, quote, "Roy, I hate for it to end like this, but it's your turn to go." He stole more than 24 of Roy Perryman's weapons, including the 30-caliber Plainfield carbine machine gun that he would later use in the Hilltop grocery murders.
Oh, wow. So he used a machine gun in those murders. Also, the way that he told him it was his time to go, that's very unempathetic, emotionless, just, hey, sorry, it's your time to go. That's rough.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to definitely get into this guy's mindset here in a little bit.
Okay.
So around midnight that night, White then met with James Livingston, 29, and his brother, Gary Livingston, 22. And together, the three headed north to McKinney in White's 1966 white Pontiac. They discussed how they only had $2 between them and that they would need to rob a store for money. White told the Livingston brothers that they would need to kill any potential witnesses to the robbery. They then headed east a few miles from McKinney on Highway 380, headed to Princeton, when they saw the Hilltop grocery store. It was about 6:30 in the morning on May 11th when they pulled into the parking lot. Preston Broyles, the store owner, was already outside helping St. John and Coker put oil into their truck. Broyles came over and began pumping gas into the Pontiac when White pulled the 30-caliber carbine and ordered the three men into the store. Gary Livingston stayed outside the store serving as a lookout, while White, with the 30-caliber carbine, and James Livingston with a 22-caliber pistol, followed the three men inside. White forced Broyles to open the register and made all three men hand over their wallets. White then ordered the three men to lay face down on the floor. At this point, one of the men made a comment to White that apparently angered him. White said, "I wish you hadn't said nothing. I'm going to kill you." Which is very interesting because basically in the moment, he's now blaming the murders on the victim.
Yeah.
As if saying, "This is your fault because you just pissed me off."
So that's weird. He's, like you said, he's kind of victim blaming in a sense where he's saying, "Oh, the only reason I had to kill this guy is because he had said something that I didn't agree with." But we already know that he had planned to kill anyone who was a witness to the robbery beforehand.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, at White's comment, James Livingston aimed the .22 handgun at the man's head, but White pushed him away, saying, "He's mine." Robert Excel White then shot each man multiple times. The final victim, and it's not known which victim it was, began begging for his life. White said to him, "God damn it, you've got to go too. I'm not going to leave any witnesses." Now, to be fair, James Livingston denies this is exactly what happened that morning. He admits to having the pistol, but he says he did not enter the store until after he heard the gunshots. So he basically argues that he had even less to do with the murders than what is laid out in White's case.
Well, that's convenient for him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, White and the Livingston brothers then left the store with the money from the register and from the victim's wallets. Many sources state that they took $6 from the cash register and $60 from the victim's wallets for a total of $66 to split between the three.
Wow.
However, the court documents specify that each man received $65 after they split the money up. Even with this higher figure, that means that three men, Preston Broyles, Gary Coker, and Billy St. John, died for a score of about, in today's money, less than $350 each.
That just doesn't seem to equate to the amount of human life that it was lost in this event.
No, absolutely not. And you can see how it was completely unnecessary. There's no reason why these men had to die.
Are there any more details as to were they trying to get these weapons that they stole from the first victim to someone they could sell them to in Mississippi across state lines?
That's one of the good questions that I don't know. I'm not sure why they were going to McKinney in the first place. I don't know if they were going just to rob someplace. I don't know what was in their minds at the time.
That would be interesting to know. I just wish we had more details about, you know, what his plan was and White and what he was planning to do after robbing his friend, finding two accomplices, robbing another grocery store. Like, what was he planning on doing?
I'm not really sure that he had a plan at this point. I think that he was traveling to McKinney. They were trying to get out of their immediate area because they lived in Waco. They were trying to get out of their immediate area and go find somebody else to rob. And I think he wanted to kill other people. I think he kind of got the taste of it. and he wanted to try that out as well. But I don't know that for sure because, like I said, we don't have those details of what was going through his mind, what the plan was, if there was one. That's one of the questions that I have around this case. Well, White and the Livingston brothers traveled back to Waco, where White dumped the gun used in the murders off a bridge into the Brazos River. James Livingston fled to California, while Gary Livingston and White decided to take off to Mississippi. But on the way, Gary Livingston and White got into an argument, and White threatened to shoot him. Gary asked to be let out of the car, which was probably smart, considering he knew that this man just killed four people. And so White left him in Tyler, Texas. White continued on to his hometown of Cleveland, Mississippi, and went to his cousin Johnny White's home, arriving there on May 14th, just 3 days after the murders. There, he confessed to his cousin the details of all four murders. He went on to say that now that he was back home, he had plans to kill a Mississippi judge who had convicted him of a DUI the previous year.
Really?
Yep, so he is already planning additional murders at this point. But in what turns out to be probably the most shocking part of this whole story, Johnny convinced White to turn himself in to the sheriff's department. Now, exactly what Johnny said to White to convince him to do this, I couldn't find out. But it's remarkable that this happened. White had just murdered four men in cold blood, completely unprovoked. To turn yourself in would demonstrate some kind of remorse or feelings of guilt, right?
Yeah.
But White didn't feel that way at all. White gave a full and detailed account of his murder spree while in Mississippi to those authorities and to Texas officials as he was brought back to Texas. Authorities said that he showed no remorse about the murders, and when asked directly how he felt about the murders at the Hilltop Grocery, he said it was, quote, just like stepping on a fly. They also said he seemed proud of the murders. So let's get that clear. He's proud of killing an old man and two kids as they lay face down on the ground and stabbing another man to death who was his friend.
Yeah.
He's proud of that.
Seems like we got a real sociopath at least on our hands.
I think that's probably a fair assessment.
But why though? Like what caused him to have a change of heart? That's what I want to know. How did his cousin convince him to go to the sheriff's station?
That's a really good question, and we don't know. But what we do know is that his cousin, Johnny, later said that when he asked White why he killed Ron Perryman, his friend, White told him, quote, he had been dreaming of killing somebody and just wanted to kill him to see how it was. Robert Exel White was so unemotional about his crimes that authorities began calling him Exel the Executioner. His confession and interviews led to the arrests of both James and Gary Livingston. 28 guns belonging to Roy Perryman were recovered from White's vehicle, but the 30 caliber carbine used in the Hilltop grocery store was not among them. Remember, White had thrown this into the Brazos River. Well, he told authorities this, and the weapon was recovered, and ballistics testing would confirm that the shell casings found at the scene were a match to the recovered weapon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So now we have everything we need for a speedy trial and conviction, right?
That's what it seems like.
Yeah. Well, later in 1974, the trial began. We have a confession, we have recovered the murder weapon, and we also have a long line of people to testify at what a sack of crap this guy was. First, several officers testified to his lack of remorse following his arrest and how he said that the murders were like swatting a fly or shooting fish in a barrel. White's ex-wife testified that he had repeatedly beat her and threatened to kill her during their marriage, and that she had witnessed him beating a previous wife while she was in her third trimester of pregnancy.
Ooh.
Another of White's former friends testified that in September of 1972, he and White had been hanging out with some friends when, completely unprovoked, White came up behind him and slit his throat with a hunting knife.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. This guy sounds like a monster.
Yeah, absolutely. The state also introduced letters that White had written to his wife while in jail awaiting his murder trial. The letters threatened her and a man that he thought she was leaving him for. The following is a couple of excerpts from one of these letters. Quote, if you are still married to me when I get out of here, I'm coming to Montana and taking what is mine, and you are mine as long as you are married to me. It's very dangerous to play around with someone's wife and love life in future. You might should pass that message on to that son of a bitch that split us up, because he's playing a dangerous fucking game, and it could very easy cost him dearly. More than he wants to pay, too. So tell him I said walk slow and watch out for shadows in the dark, because my shadow can creep up when he's least expecting them. Do you catch my drift, Margaret? Your husband, love Excel.
creepy and very nefariously written.
Yeah, exactly. He's awaiting trial for capital murder, and he is threatening people. Multiple people at this point.
This guy sounds like a maniac.
Johnny White, so this was the cousin who helped convince White to turn himself in, also testified that White was dangerous, stating that White was, quote, a threat and always will be. A detention officer testified that after Johnny White's testimony, White became enraged and threatened Johnny during a recess. Exel White then told the officer, quote, I guess you could see what I wanted to do back there. That's all right. I'll get the son of a bitch. So now he's threatening people from prison while awaiting trial, and now he's actively threatening people during his capital murder trial.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah. Last but certainly not least, White had been compelled to undergo psychiatric exams by two psychiatrists. Both doctors were then called in to testify for the prosecution concerning White's mindset and propensity for violence.
Oh, interesting. I want to hear about this.
Yeah. Both psychiatrists testified that Robert Exel White had an extreme antisocial personality disorder, that he was dangerous to society and would continue to be dangerous, and that there was no cure or rehabilitation known for a man like him. Ultimately, they agree that he would have a high chance of recidivism should he ever be released. All par for the course, right? We've heard these kinds of statements to describe many violent offenders, and it sounds perfectly logical, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, he sounds like a psychopath or a sociopath, or at least someone with antisocial personality disorder to some degree. And we know what that means, that those people typically cannot be rehabilitated when they become violent offenders. So yeah, lock them up, throw away the key. That's what I say.
Well, the jury agreed with you, but they would do one more, because on August 26, 1974, White was found guilty for the murder of Preston Broyles. He was sentenced to death. Now, eagle-eared listeners who are really familiar with Texas law concerning the death penalty may be a little mystified at that. If we go back to your episode on Kenneth Allen McDuff, what do we recall happening in the 1970s pertaining to the death penalty in the United States?
Yes, we have talked about this a few times. They did away with it.
That's right. In 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court in Furman v. Georgia struck down the death penalty throughout the nation. Here in Texas, that meant everyone on death row at the time, 52 people to be exact, got their death sentences converted to life sentences. And we know how great that was for the broomstick killer.
Yeah, didn't work out so well.
For the rest of us.
Oh, yeah. For him, I guess it was the greatest thing ever.
It was fantastic for him. Yeah. Now, the Supreme Court decision was that the particular statutes surrounding the death penalty were unconstitutional, not the death penalty itself, meaning that if states revised these statutes to correct the problems found in the Furman v. Georgia case, bing, bang, boom, you got yourself the ability to execute people again. The following year, in 1973, certain aspects of the capital punishment laws were revised in the state of Texas and around the country. Specifically, some of these revisions included splitting up the guilt-innocent phase and sentencing phase of a trial, and the definition of crimes that one could be executed for also became more limited in scope. So this was all to establish a more consistent use of the death penalty and, in theory at least, make it less discriminatory. And so people began, again, being sentenced to death within this time period in Texas, but the punishments just couldn't be carried out until if and when the death penalty was reinstated by the Supreme Court. So around the time 74, 75, Texas was still sentencing people to death, even though technically they couldn't go through with it. And it wasn't until 1976 when a Supreme Court decision in Gregg v. Georgia again reinstated the death penalty. Now, then in the late 70s, it's game on in Texas for executions once again.
So you basically are putting executions on layaway, so to speak.
That's a pretty accurate way to look at it.
Interesting.
After serving just 2 years on death row, White appeared to want to give up further appeals. In fact, he actually wrote to the Supreme Court stating he was, quote, opposed to further appeals. He also gave interviews to that effect, basically trying to come off like a martyr for the cause against the death penalty. In one interview, he said, quote, I'm not for the death penalty, period. I'm giving myself up, for example, to let the people know that capital punishment is not the way. Which, shut up, Exel.
Yeah.
Exel, however you say your name, there are plenty of people who could probably relate a sympathetic case that would make you question the death penalty. A domestic abuser and unprovoked murderer of four people is probably not the case.
Yeah, you're a horrible trash human. Can I say that about Mr. XL White?
Yeah, you can. He's somebody who isn't really a sympathetic character.
No. And it seems like he skated through his entire life, getting away with everything he could, never being charged with anything except for that DUI that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And he should have been flagged and caught earlier on, and we should have marked this guy as a danger to society.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like he should have served time for any number of those beatings that he carried out on people, or it looks like attempted murder on his friend when he tried to slit his throat, but he didn't. He skated on by, like you said, and this is something that we see pretty common, especially in this period of time, the 70s. It seems like people just really got away with violent crimes a lot of the times, and then suddenly, guess what? They build up to murder.
Yeah. You just let too many monsters slip through the cracks.
Yeah. So even though he makes this big deal about how he wants to drop his appeals and everything, his lawyers convinced him to continue to press on with appealing his death sentence. And so that's what they did. Then in 1987, after serving 11 years on death row, something really weird happened. White's conviction was overturned by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Why? Is what I'm sure we're all wondering.
I have a giant question mark on that topic.
Well, do you remember those two psychiatric evaluations White had been compelled by the court to take that led to the damning testimony from the psychiatrist describing what a piece of garbage he was?
Oh, yes, indeed, I do.
Well, it just so happened that White had not been told beforehand that anything he said in the evaluations could be used against him in trial.
Oh, my goodness. So they basically didn't read him Miranda rights before those evaluations?
Well, that's not exactly how it goes, but that's basically the idea. But this is the thing. In 1974, the time of his first trial, that was perfectly legal. It wasn't mandated that you had to let somebody know that their conversations with a psychiatrist could be used against them in a court of law.
Oh, really?
But this later ruling in 1987 declared that such warnings were now mandatory, and it was allowed to be applied retroactively by the Supreme Court, which means that after 11 years on death row, White would now have to be given a new trial. The idea here is that the psychiatrist's testimony helped the jury decide that he was a continuing threat, and that could have influenced their decision to give him the death penalty as opposed to a life sentence.
Which was completely legal at the time.
It was, but he was compelled to participate in the evaluations, and he wasn't told that those evaluations could be used against him. So, I mean, it makes sense, but it's still frustrating. But do not fret, for White's second trial began just months later on June 8th, 1987. White was again found guilty for the murder of Preston Broyles. Before sentencing, Robert St. John, brother of Billy St. John, stated, "I believe I speak for all my family when I say we won't be happy until the jury comes back with the death penalty." And I guess he was really happy because the jury deliberated for only 2 hours before again sentencing White to death. And so, once again, the mandatory appeals process began anew with White's second conviction. And White continued living on death row for an additional 12 years as the appeals process dragged on.
Wow, that seems like he's building up quite the time period here on death row.
That's right. He was on death row for so long that he got a new nickname, the Dean of Texas Death Row. And according to the Associated Press, White was on death row for so long that he actually kind of got cocky about it, insinuating that just maybe he'd never actually be put to death. Fellow inmates said he said things like, quote, "They just can't get around to killing me because I've been here longer than anyone else."
Okay. That just seems like a weird badge of honor to carry around.
Yeah, it kind of was. According to Christy Hopp of the Dallas Morning News in an article from 1992, Robert XL White's two trials and multiple appeals cost the state of Texas $4 million.
Ooh.
She also wrote, quote, "White's case represents the death penalty system at its most costly and inefficient. This underlines a study done by the Dallas Morning News that found it's actually much less expensive to sentence someone to life in prison versus the death sentence. That study found that, on average, a death sentence resulted in 7.5 years of appeals and cost taxpayers an average of $2 million per case in Texas. In comparison, the cost to imprison someone for 40 years was about $750,000. So a lot of people naturally point to this case as demonstrating how screwed up capital punishment remained in Texas even after all of those revisions in the 1970s.
Well, that's an interesting point of discussion. So we both have our own problems with capital punishment.
Absolutely.
In Texas. We also both kind of see where you could use capital punishment to, you know, get on with some of these cases where you have people who are going to continue to do these horrible crimes, even if they're released. You can't rehabilitate them. But you're saying that this case is a great example why XL White should have been kept in life imprisonment. It would have saved taxpayer dollars. Maybe it would have given the family closure early on if he was only sentenced to life and hadn't gone through these capital punishment appeals.
Well, I'm not necessarily arguing that, but I'm saying that's what people have argued, that this is a really perfect example to show how screwed up the system is. And obviously, you know, we're talking about all of these trials and appeals and everything going on for, I'm going to break it to you right now, almost 25 years, and you have to consider all of the families that he destroyed who are having to go sit through all of these court cases, all of these appeals, waiting to figure out what happens. Mm-hmm. And that's also another big problem when it comes to capital punishment, is that these things can drag on for so long. You're constantly dragging the family through so much pain and turmoil every time something comes up. And so that's another issue.
Yeah, reliving the crime, reliving the horror.
Yeah.
It begs the question of, like, what are we doing this for? Is this really serving the purpose that we set out for it to do, to supposedly get quick justice and retribution or some kind of closure, where we know with victims and survivors and family members, there is no real thing as closure with these cases, that they're just survivors. And when you put them through this kind of treatment again, they're just continuing to have to survive and persevere. So who are we really serving here? It's not the taxpayer. It's not the survivors. What's going on? What are we doing with this?
Yeah, and I mean, it's a really good question, especially considering that most other countries don't have the death penalty any longer. I mean, we're one of the few remaining countries that still has capital punishment. And obviously not every state has it, but Texas really, really, really loves it.
Well, and
even today,
you know, we've talked about it before. On really bad years, we've executed upwards of 50 something people in a year. And on average, I think it's in the 30s. I want to say, like, 20s to 30s.
Well, it has decreased in recent years. Like I said, it looks like we're going to be ending 2018 with 13 this year.
And we've both said there are certain individuals with certain specific crimes where, hey, capital punishment might be warranted in those cases.
I think in extreme cases, it's understandable. But I think it is applied too liberally even today.
Yeah. And not to mention when you start putting people and families and victims through this Rube Goldberg justice system that you've created with all these appeals and, you know, revisions of what criminal punishment should and shouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, and then at the same time, you don't want to say, well, let's fast track and streamline the process, because then what happens if and when you execute somebody and then find out later that they were innocent? What do you do?
Yeah.
These are all of the issues that we're seeing, and I think they're all really good questions.
Yeah, because guess what? Texas also leads the country in wrongful convictions.
Oh, yes. And we're definitely looking at covering some of those cases here pretty soon as well. Well, Robert Exel White was finally executed by lethal injection on March 30th, 1999, almost a quarter of a century after his crimes. At the time, he was the longest serving inmate on death row in Texas history. His last meal, would you like to know?
Sure, why not?
It was two hamburgers, a double order of French fries, and onion rings. That was according to the Dallas Morning News.
Ugh.
As he was being led to the death chamber, he told prison officials, "Well, you finally got me." His last words were, quote, "Send me to my maker, warden." He was 61 years old, meaning that he was at the time also the oldest man to be executed in Texas history. He was never tried for the murders of Roy Perryman, Gary Coker, or Billy St. John. Robert St. John, 38, the brother of one of White's victims, attended White's execution and spoke to the Dallas Morning News about his great relief. Quote, "It was great. I enjoyed watching the man die. I really did. He did comment, however, that it was really too easy and that the condemned prisoner did not appear to suffer. So, I mean, that's another thing. Some victims' families, they feel like it gives them something. You know, silver lining in all of this is maybe it did bring them some sort of sense of peace.
Yeah, probably just because they don't ever have to do this ever
again. After 25 years of his 18-year-old brother being murdered for absolutely no reason whatsoever.
Yep. But then you have to pair that with all the other families that talk about how horrible it is to go through this process.
Yeah.
Over and over and over.
Yeah, absolutely. None of it is easy.
I mean, we had a case where a guy went to death row and all the families and of the victim showed up, and then they were told they had to go home and travel back across the state because they were going to do it, you know, in a week's time. And they had to drive all the way back and then, you know, go through all that again, get a hotel, get prepared for it. I mean, I have no idea what you have to go through when you're expecting to go and witness your family member's murderer get put to death like the next day. Ugh, that's rough.
Yeah, it sure is. And I think it's one of those things where nobody wants to be put in that position. I'm not going to condemn or comment upon any victims' families about how they feel about something like that.
Sure. Because all their feelings are valid.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are a lot of victims' families in these cases where they don't want to see the person put to death. They have really strong moral and ethical quandaries with the death sentence. And they actually sometimes, you know, beg the court system, please don't do this. This is not what we want. And I think that that's equally as valid. So, yeah, just things to think about in all of this. Well, James Livingston was also tried for capital murder and was also given the death sentence. But in April of 1983, his sentence was commuted to life in prison. Gary Dale Livingston was convicted and received a 20-year sentence. Gary is the one who was outside of the store the entire time.
Yeah.
Did not actually participate in any way.
Yeah, he said he was pumping the gas. Or he stayed out by the gas
pumps. He was a lookout.
Yeah.
So he received a 20-year sentence. He was released early on parole after serving 9 years in prison in July of 1984. He committed suicide 2 years later.
Oh.
And that's all I know about that.
What do you say about that?
Yeah. At least in the grocery store murders, not including Roy Perryman, you know, a crime that lasted maybe 15, 20 minutes. How many people did that destroy?
What's the delta change of the minutes that were spent in that grocery store versus the years that were spent in courtrooms and suffering for everyone else? Wow. What a horrific case.
I know. It's really sad. It's really upsetting. I don't know. It's just really depressing case. It really is. And like I said, it's really sad that we don't know that much about the victims. I can't even give you a picture to at least look at and, you know, feel that connection to them because those things aren't available to us. So, yeah, it's just a really sad story that we know more about the piece of garbage who murdered all these people than we know about the people themselves.
But at least you were able to dig up comments from the family regarding some of the appeals and also the death sentence itself. That was interesting to hear from the family.
Yeah.
And it's nice to hear from them sometimes because a lot of times, like you said, they don't want to speak out. They don't want to come forward. I will ask you, though, do you think that Exel White was bordering on a serial killer?
I think if he hadn't turned himself in, that he probably would have gone on to kill more people.
Because like you said, he was already planning on murdering a judge in Mississippi.
Yeah, I mean, just based on how absolutely remorseless he was, not only just after he turned himself in, but in the years after, I mean, he never showed any sense of guilt or remorse for the horrible things that he did. And I think he kind of enjoyed killing people. I don't think it bothered him.
Well, the way he reported his crimes to the detectives, like they said, it sounded like he was proud of it.
Yeah.
And boy, that's a giant red flag.
Yeah. And that's kind of the most bizarre thing about the whole thing is, so how do you go from that to turning yourself in? I mean, if he was proud, did he want the accolades of being found out, of being able to tell people about what he had done?
Yeah,
I don't know.
What could his relative have told him to convince him to turn himself in?
But we need to say thank you, Johnny White. Because what a brave guy to come forward to convince him somehow. I don't know what Johnny White was doing, but he worked some kind of miracle magic that day to convince him to turn himself in. And then he went forward and testified against the guy
He seemed to have empathy, for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you can tell that he was like, this guy's a monster and we need to put him away forever.
Yeah.
Thank you, Johnny White, because without him, I think it's definitely sure that Axel White would have gone on to kill more people.
Sure. He would have had more blood in his wake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Well, that was a terrifying and awful case, but I'm glad we talked about it because the implications, like you said, for the judicial system and the topics that we got to discuss today were really interesting. And I did enjoy that part of the discussion. But boy, what a brutal case.
I know. Really sad one.
Well, next week, we're going to give you a holiday episode that is going to be Christmas-themed, we believe. So keep an eye out for that. So we'll have maybe a change of pace there.
I mean, it's whatever you decide to do. It's your case, buddy.
And then right after that, we're going to have our anniversary episode. So for the anniversary episode, we definitely need you guys to send in your questions, comments, cow jokes, etc. Anything you want us to read on that episode, we will look at those emails and we will go through them. Send it to allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. And we're going to have an anniversary end of year spectacular for that episode. So get those in.
Yes, get those in soon because that's going to be coming up on December 20th. That is the day of our anniversary, and that is when the episode will be coming out. So please get them in before that period.
That's right.
Folks.
Well, I think after all that, it might be time for an uplifting holiday surprise of heartwarming nature that we like to call good news. So this week's good news comes to us from our favorite sports team in the DFW Metroplex, the Dallas Stars, Aaron.
Woo-woo!
Yeah, they're fighting for a position for the playoffs coming up in the spring. And one thing we know about the Dallas Stars is they have a great Dallas Stars organization that does a lot of charity for the DFW area. That typically is done by the team in conjunction with some of their star players. And this is a tradition that has really taken off over the last 10 years with this current round of players that have been on the Dallas Stars. They've all joined in with a lot of great initiatives and charities to help people in and around the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And John Klingberg, the star Dallas defenseman, one of the best defensemen in the league, has not bucked this tradition. He has started an organization called Klinger's Kids, and he did this about 2 years ago, and it's just ramped up and taken off as he's gotten more and more involved with this program. This all started back when defenseman John Klingberg, who hails from Sweden and from the same town as former Dallas Stars great Louis Erickson, which was one of your favorite players. Yeah. Whenever he'd score, you'd hear a chant of Lou. Well, Louis Erickson was a huge hometown hero in Gothenburg, Sweden, and John Klingberg was just a kid when Louis Erickson was a huge, massive star in the NHL, and he was a hero for him, being from the same town. And whenever Louis Erickson would come back to Gothenburg, Sweden, he would see Louis doing all these charity activities with young kids and youth groups, building ice rinks and helping kids with disabilities to have opportunities. It stayed with John Klingberg his whole career. And once he finally made it to the same team, the Dallas Stars, he wanted to continue this tradition that Louis Erickson had fostered in him. So he made Klinger's Kids. And motivated out of that example, this Dallas Stars Foundation program is developed to help kids that are 18 years or under who suffer from life-threatening illnesses. Each month, John Klingberg hand-selects children and their families to attend specific games and partner with them to develop their own charity program around their particular illness or disease. One of the neatest parts of this program, though, is that each child selected will also receive a Tempur-Pedic mattress delivered by Levitt's Mattresses to help them while they're recuperating or recovering from their life-threatening disease. I mean, as we know, a lot of these kids spend a lot of time in rehab or in hospitals, you know, getting treatment at home, recuperating from these treatments, and those mattresses go a long way to helping them with things like bed sores or anything with being in the same position over and over, days after days. So I think that's pretty awesome that this mattress company has stepped up to provide those. So one of the first children to participate in Clinger's Kids was Aiden Norris. Aiden was about 4 years old when he was diagnosed with stage 4 neuroblastoma high-risk cancer. He had a tumor in his stomach, and it was cancerous, and it started to spread through his entire body, and he had the tumor removed, and has since started a long-term treatment and recovery process to fight off any recurring cancer that might be related to that original cancerous tumor. This is a very rare type of cancer, and the recovery diagnosis is not very good. He only has a 45 to 50% survival rate, so it can relapse. So right now, Aiden is undergoing chemotherapy and immunotherapy, and he's doing well, and his treatments seem to be helping. Raina Norris, Aiden's mom, says, quote, "It really means a lot to him. We started coming to games when Aiden was 11 months old. We always made sure to come to at least a few games a season, but last year we weren't able to. This is because of Aiden's diagnosis and having his tumor removed." And Raina also said, now that his immune system is higher and doing better, they can do more things like going to his favorite thing to do, which is a Dallas Stars game. And Aiden was very obviously excited for his experience to go and meet his favorite player, which was John Klingberg, and meet his team and go out and do pre-skate and warm-ups and go to the locker room. And they talk about this in the Stars Insider that happened back in November. Well, since then, John Klingberg has actually partnered up with another family. You know, back in November, John Klingberg had a terrible injury where he had basically both bones in his arm broken and has had to undergo surgery and has had a long recovery period himself. But John Klingberg took this time to spend more of his off-ice time with these kids in Klinger's Kids program. One of them is Brody Nelson. So back in January, Brody Nelson, who was 11 years old at the time, was diagnosed with a terrible brain tumor that was about the size of a plum. He was rushed to the hospital at Cook Children's, and they removed this plum-sized tumor, but unfortunately, over the next couple of months, it grew back. And it is a very aggressive style of brain tumor, and he was able to actually get into an experimental cancer treatment for brain tumors of this type over in Dallas, and he's been doing well with it over the last, you know, 9 months or so. So back when they did the Hockey Fights Cancer Night for the Dallas Stars last month, they had Brody Nelson come out and drop the puck for that night. And it was a huge thing. They had his whole family there. John Klingberg came out. He got to meet all the players. They raised a bunch of money leading up to this event. Brody actually told his parents, like, wow, before I drop the puck at this game tonight, we've raised all this money. It'd be great if we could give some of this money back to this new center that I'm receiving treatment at, St. Jude's, and give it back in the form of Legos for kids who are suffering from cancer like me to play with while they go through their treatment. That night at the Hockey Fights Cancer game, they opened it up for fans to bring unopened packages of Legos to the game, and they had this massive outpouring of Legos donated by fans for Brody and his new program to give back. So when Brody saw all the Legos that showed up, it was basically a giant room full of Lego boxes. And he was so excited, and he had this big smile that went from cheek to cheek, you know, ear to ear, that he could bring back to some of the people that he had met at St. Jude's and give them himself to help them out with their treatment as they went through cancer. John Klingberg really took this whole project on and really helped Brody out and enjoyed his participation in it the whole time. And he kind of gets emotional in it during the video with the Dallas Stars Insider. And at the time, he's going through just a broken arm, but, you know, he's injured at the time, and he gets to spend all this time with Brody, and he's like, wow, this really opened my eyes and changed my perspective, because here's this kid who just doesn't give up and never stops and keeps going, and he's such a light and an inspiration for other kids who are going through the same kind of thing. And here I am just with a broken arm, and I'm, you know, kind of sad on myself for my injury, but here's this kid who's this brilliant light of hope. So I think it's a great partnership between the Dallas Stars, the Dallas Stars Foundation, the players, and these kids. It's awesome. I love hearing stories like this.
Yeah, it's a really great story. And that's really awesome that he was able to raise all of this stuff for St. Jude's, which is a really fantastic organization. If you ever are like, I would really want to give money to a charity, St. Jude's is always a great way to go. They provide services to children and their families at no cost to them. And it's just such a fantastic organization. Can't say enough about it. And it's a really great story to see kids helping out other kids who have this, you know, are undergoing the same pressures and stress and all of those emotions that they must be feeling when they're going through something that as difficult as dealing with a disease at such a young age. And it just, it's a really sweet story. And, good on Brody and Aiden and all of those kids who are doing these things, because, you know, it's got to be hard.
Yeah, there you go. Hockey and kids and fighting cancer and Legos.
All right, everyone. Thanks for sticking around for the after show. We're going to go ahead and skip the recommendation of the week because this is a long episode. And you know what? Time is of the essence.
Time is money. Podcasting is a lot of time. Therefore, oh, podcasting should equal a lot of money, right?
Don't say. Before we do some of the last iTunes reviews that we read on the air for your pleasure, we would like to extend a great big thank you to Mike of the Dark Poutine podcast,
oh,
who
yeah.
came down last week. We hung out all day. We went out to the JFK Museum.
The sixth-floor museum.
The sixth-floor museum, which was a really great time.
Yeah.
I'm kind of embarrassed to admit that neither one of us had ever been there.
It's a great museum.
It was very interesting. Definitely would recommend if you live in the area or if you're visiting the area, go check that out.
Yeah, get the audio tour. It's only $16, and yeah. It's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. Then we got to tool around with Mike. And then later on that evening, we went to a Dallas Stars game. The Dallas Stars won 4-1 against the Oilers.
Yeah.
Mike is just like you'd think he is. He's fun and funny and fantastic and charming. And we love the guy even more than we did before.
Yeah. And we got to hang out with a couple of handfuls of fans for both Dark Poutine and All Crime No Cattle. And that was really cool to get to meet some of our fans and
yes.
hang out with us. And if you'd like to come to another meetup, we have one coming up in March. In the last week of March, we're going to meet up in Fort Worth with a bunch of other Texas true crime podcasts and Southern Fried True Crime. And we'll be putting more out about that in the weeks coming. But yeah, there's going to be more opportunities for you guys to come out and meet your favorite podcasters. And we totally recommend it. It's a lot of fun. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Lisa L., for setting up the Dallas Stars game meetup. And we're thinking about doing it again. We had a lot of positive feedback from it.
Yeah, and speaking of Lisa L., thank you, our dear friend, for being a producer
yes.
and being a Texas Ranger. You're the best.
Yeah,
you're
amazing.
It was great hanging out with Lisa, wasn't it?
Yeah, she was wonderful.
Yeah.
She was very sweet, just funny, and she's a super big Stars fan, so we immediately got along, me and her. We talked hockey, and you and Lisa got to hang out and go to the pro shop together. You bought some merch together, and yeah, it was a good time.
It was a beautiful day. I loved it.
Let's do more of that.
Sure. All right, guys, remember, you can find us online on our social media. We are at ACNC Podcast on Twitter. We are at All Crime No Cattle on Instagram. You can find us on our Facebook page at All Crime No Cattle. If you just search that, our page will pop up. And remember, get your questions, comments, dumb remarks, and whatever else that you would like to be read on the show in at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. It is very important that you do that.
Also,
and thank you for your service.
Yes, thank you for your service. And also, we have a merch shop sale going on right now until the first of the year, and we have All Crime No Cattle leggings for the ladies set up at a reduced price. So get your leggings. They look awesome. They have the Rose and Bones on one side and then our name on the other side.
They are super cool looking.
They're really cool.
I'm so excited to order mine.
Yeah, and somebody already bought a pair and they practice jiu-jitsu at their local jiu-jitsu dojo. And they're planning on wearing their leggings to go and practice martial arts, which I think is badass.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, we also have some fancy, cool slip-on shoes that are available on the site. And then everything on the site is on sale right now. So go get it. Get your free shipping. Get you some really reduced prices on your All Crime No Cattle merch. If you know somebody who's a fan, get them some Christmas presents. And then most importantly, post pictures of it. We want to see your Rose and Bones.
That's right.
Well, with no further ado, let's get to these iTunes 5-star reviews. We got a couple to get through. We got Haven Walters, 1978. They say, love, 5 stars. I heard about this podcast in one of my Facebook groups. Immediately started binge listening. The hosts are so intelligent and well-spoken, and they and they cover so many cases that I have never heard of. I love their dynamic with each other as well. I am a true crime junkie and have over 85 true crime podcasts in my library. Wow.
Dang. And that's more than me.
And this is the first review I've ever written.
Whoa.
Keep it up, Shay and Aaron. Enjoy this so much.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
That was great. Next up is Little Buckaroo. They say, great podcast, 5 stars. I love this true crime podcast. Shay and Aaron make a great team. They bring new cases with lots of background as well as just enough humor. Another great addition to the true crime family.
Oh, thank you.
I'm just happy to be in the true crime family.
Yeah, we're like the drunk uncle.
We're at the kids' table over there, that folding table that doesn't even have a tablecloth on it with like the derelict uncle sitting over there.
Yeah.
Yep. But hey, we're just happy to be there.
Yeah.
Karaoke? But it's spelled like Kari, so I wonder if it's like a Kari Lettinen, the old goalie for the Dallas Stars reference. I don't know. Karaoke
That's
says.
That's a stretch, babe.
Well, I'm hoping. It's my hopes that they're a Kari fan. They say, love the show, 5 stars. I love the show. I love the research and I love the clean language. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're freaking welcome. Shut the front door. I'm so happy you reviewed us.
God bless America.
Lone Star Love says, very good. I've been waiting for someone to cover less well-known crimes. The Kiva is one that still haunts me. Wow, well, thank you. That was a tough episode to do, and I enjoyed researching it for you. I still have a lot of hot crime opinions about that one.
Yeah, that was a messed up case for sure.
Talialana says, best intro. As a person with an unhealthy collection of true crime pods, I can absolutely say this is the best intro music ever. I also really enjoy that this is just about Texas, and I won't be hearing the same cases that all the other, also good, podcasts provide.
Thank you. We appreciate it. We try to do a little something different.
Yeah. Bring some lesser known cases back to the forefront.
Yeah.
Just kick them back out front. Valerie Schmalane says, Valerie, 5 stars.
Wait, wait, the title was just her name?
Yep, her name.
I love it.
5 stars. Hey, you know what? She's owning it. I like it. Hands down, one of my favorite podcasts. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Valerie. Valerie. I'm going to start doing that when I comment on things. Aaron.
Just 13 Nat says, one of my new faves. I've listened to so many true crime pods. Some I listen to a few episodes and lose interest. Others I get drawn in, hooked, and binge all the episodes. This is one of those podcasts you'll want to binge. They're easy to listen to, great podcasting voices, and don't talk over each other. Well-researched and a good balance of humor and facts. I'm in Oklahoma and enjoy hearing about the crimes in our neighboring state. How did the Texas Longhorn feel when she couldn't give any milk? This is a cow joke, so you, I'm assuming you need to answer.
Well, if she's a lady, is she still considered a longhorn?
This is the way the joke is presented.
Oh, okay.
So we're assuming
I'm getting all biological with it.
It's a longhorn that is a lady.
Okay. She felt dry.
What's wow. The what if that was really the joke?
That's a that's weird person who gave that us that weird joke.
No, well, hey, don't you naysay just 13 Nat.
Oh, I'm sure it's a much better thing than what I just said.
Like an utter failure.
Oh, like an utter failure. Wah, 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 wah. That was a good one.
All right. Well, we're going to get the last August review out of the way. Liz WB says, turns out you do need another true crime pod. Just when you think there are way too many, here come the most charming couple ever. They clearly are as fascinated and enjoy the whole genre as the rest of us. Not to mention each other's company. Listening. Shut up. Listening is so enjoyable. You feel like you're hanging out like pals, which is the best pod experience. Well-researched, organized, and fun. Thank you, Liz.
Yeah, thank you, Liz.
Now we're into September. We've got only two more weeks of reviews to finish up before we're completely done with reading reviews.
Yay!
But hey, keep them coming. We love that you guys rate, comment, review the podcast. It really helps us out. And if you leave a remarkable review in the future, we will still probably read it because we love that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And we'd like to extend a special thank you to everybody out there who we've been seeing your name around posted on Reddit and Facebook groups and all of that kind of stuff with you guys going out there and recommending our show to other people. That is absolutely amazing to get more people to come in and listen to the show and hopefully they'll like it.
Yeah, it's so the lifeblood of our show.
Yeah, thank you all so much. Those of you who are doing that, that really means so much to us. And it's a great way to grow the show. So if you're a fan and you really like us and you want more people to listen, then that's a great way to do it.
Yeah, it keeps us making episodes and, you know, spending weeks researching and doing all the hard work to bring this stuff to you.
Yeah.
And we want to bring more of it to you, and we want to keep doing the show, and we love hearing you guys pitch the show to other people and love on us. It makes us feel good.
Yep.
Well, with that, I think episode 40 is in the books. We're in our 40s. What are we going to do with ourselves, Aaron? Are we going to have a podcast midlife crisis now?
Shay, I really want to tell you something.
Oh, uh-oh.
I want to stop doing this podcast and do a podcast about bats.
About bats?
I'm done with true crime. I'm totally into bats now.
If you guys got the chance to hang out with Aaron, the amount of baby bat gifts and videos that she shares with me and shows me, she's always showing me like, oh, look at this cute baby bat, it's got a diaper and
dude,
they're feeding it with a bottle.
They're so cute.
I like bats too. I want to get a bat box in the backyard. Oh man, if somebody knows how to make a bat box, make us an all crime no cattle bat box.
Oh, that'd be cool.
We'll put it in the backyard.
Anyways, guys, we gotta get out of here.
We do. Love you guys. Y'all stay classy, stay wonderful, but above all, remember, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.